Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 4th, 2013. And this week I'll be reviewing a bit of what I did over the last couple of weeks because it becomes a rather complex topic dealing with science. I was dealing with the two issues. How do you measure the size of a comet nucleus? That was last week. And 2 weeks ago, an issue which even a lot of very well-trained scientists don't understand, the spectral analysis of the coma of the comet. That's the gas and the dust that surrounds the comet nucleus. And so a lot of people are still a little foggy as to what all this means. Some people don't know the difference between an asteroid and a comet. And in a lot of senses, there is no real difference because an asteroid is an object that we see the nucleus, and it doesn't have a well-developed tail, although there are asteroids that develop into comets occasionally and then fall back into being an asteroid. And so where's the crossover? What's what here? And as it turns out, in the plasma discharge comet model, which is my model for the solar system and how comets work, all objects react as a comet. They all of them, down to the smallest dust particle, up to the biggest planet, Jupiter, or incoming object, Planet X, or entourage of objects around Planet X, all of them discharge the solar capacitor to varying degrees. So literally everything that's in the solar system, within the realm of the sun, in that solar capacitor, in that big battery out there, that plasma battery around the sun, everything can be classified as a comet. This holds true also out in the galactic world. We as a star system are moving through the galactic, intergalactic wind that comes off of our galactic nucleus because it's a fusion-based fire. There's probably other higher energy activities going on there, but basically it's just a gigantic, gigantic star at the center of our galaxy with fusion processes. And the same mechanism which creates the battery around our sun creates a battery around the nucleus of the galaxy. And so all of the same principles apply. In fact, this was what led me to understand how you travel between stars if you're a spacefaring entity, a civilization. You jump onto those electric currents that flow between the stars, and I call those the electric highways to the stars, the electric rivers. I've also used that term. And I think it's comical that NASA is trying to jump on and use that term, but they're saying, the Voyager spacecraft have moved into the magnetic highway. They just can't copy enough. The poor guys, it must be tough being a scientist at NASA. And not a lot of fresh ideas floating around there, so the best they can do is try and jump on my bandwagon here. Anyway, life in the big city's tough when you don't have a brain. But at any rate, sorry about the rude comments there, but just, okay, on with the show. But tonight's show, I will be reviewing those last couple weeks and filling in some details and giving you a better feeling for what that's like. Because I know I get to talk during the week to various listeners, and they call up, they're asking questions about, say, water filters or something else or a book. And so I get to talk to them, and they always have questions, but I didn't understand this, but I tried to understand your last show, and then they have questions. And then I get a lot of great input, people that have been following me for a long time who are really students of what I'm doing. And they come up with great questions. So, in fact, I'm going to lead off this show with one of those types of questions here. I actually posted it on my webpage, but a lot of people don't get to see the webpage, so I'm going to read it here. By the way, the webpage, jmccsci.com, short for jmccanniscience.com. But this is a letter from a listener, an email. And I mention this on my webpage. I say, a very interesting question for NASA, who ain't talking about this. It says, hi, Jim. NASA, Space.com, and all the other NASA affiliates keep saying that Comet C2012-S1, or ISON as it is called, might possibly be known as the comet of the century because of how bright it may become and also able to be seen during daylight. But the one thing that those many commentaries, is that they do not show, indicate any proof or reason why this should be about this comet. Other than being able to see the comet move from a far distance from Earth telescopes, I don't believe that there is any, has been any satellites that have been sent towards it close enough to explore and analyze for its inner content. And that seems to be true. I mean, they're just looking from a distance at this comet. Okay, so anyway, the listener continues. NASA is trying to subliminally say to the public that ISON is packed with so much dense ice, in its parentheses, dense because NASA says that this comet nucleus is not very big at all, end of parentheses, that it will emit, eject all this ice at distances far enough from its nucleus to be able to make it shine and be seen from Earth even during daylight. So my question is, with no real clues other than size behind NASA's Comet of the Century claim, why would NASA even bother to make such a prediction about it anyways? If they're making an educated guess about ISON having packed ice and water deep in its core, then would it not stand to reason that NASA should be able to know if the planet Mars has any by now also, indicating, and I'll just make a side note here, this is a very good logical conclusion or question. If NASA says that this nucleus for ISON is supposed to have so much water that's going to make this amazing tail from this ice and water on the nucleus, then, and they're saying it's small, then logically, all of that ejecta matter has to be packed down inside the nucleus, not just surface layer. So if NASA has the wherewithal to estimate the density and the composition and the chemistry composition of deep inside this nucleus, how come they can't do it at Mars and tell us how much water there is on Mars? And of course, the answer is that they cannot. So these are so-called educated guesses. Okay, I'm going to continue reading from the listener's email. Did I miss something here? Did NASA send a C-2012-S1 rover on a secret mission to discover the content of this comet nucleus? And then I make a comment here on the webpage in brackets. I say, or did NASA see this coming from afar and saw it for what it is, a giant nucleus? The release of discovery was most odd, coming on September 21st, 2012, the fall equinox, and they never named the comet after the so-called discoverers, something also unprecedented in comet discoveries from the ISON Institute. End of my inserted comment. Okay, now the last paragraph from the listeners. How the H does NASA know that this comet will be the most significant comet to pass through our solar system since and for X amount of time, unless they know what you know, that comets are not dirty snowballs and the light emitting from it will have nothing to do with ice being ejected from its core at high velocities, that only a truly massive and electrically charged comet could possibly glow like they say it will. And right about now, size is the only sure thing that NASA has been able to scientifically measure from Earth, given the short amount of time since its discovery. Could you please shed some light on this NASA BS we keep hearing and reading about? Okay, so anyway, that's a great observation. And every week, I'm getting more and more listener commentary where they are seeing through, analyzing, and then comparing this with that. That's a great comparison where the if they supposedly can make some kind of estimate of the composite of this comet nucleus from afar, then how come they can't do this on Mars? And all of the big questions about Mars. I'll be talking a little bit about Mars, some other issues here in a minute. But anyway, I comment here, I say, that's an excellent question. Thanks once again to my listeners who truly are understanding the BS that is coming from NASA. And remember that the prediction of immense brightness comes after this comet is destined to plummet through the solar outer atmosphere and the intense corona, in which any pea-brain moron would understand that nothing of the so-called ices and snow would remain. So why the dire prediction of immense brightness that is supposedly to come after this comet dives through the sun? Surely a mixture of ideas here. Remember the comet Lovejoy that surprised and negated astronomers' predictions and came out of the solar atmosphere to form a comet larger than the one that entered the sun. How does that work, Mr. NASA Dirty Snowball Expert? In my new ebook, Comets, I show all of the photos to date of comet nuclei, taken at close range by visiting satellites, and none, yes, drum roll, none, show any trace of water, ice, or snow, and none of show any water escaping from the nucleus. Comet Halley's nucleus is known to be the blackest object in the solar system. To boot, these nuclei are hot, real hot. Comet Vild 2 has a surface layer of hot black tar, hydrocarbons baked onto the surface, no snow. The NASA story is getting real thin. And remember, NASA still refuses to acknowledge the close encounter that Comet Icen will have this coming September and early October with the planet Mars. An event unprecedented in thousands of years of sky watching, and they just happen to not mention in any of their news releases or so-called organized viewing sessions, which, by the way, they all start November, a full month and a half after the close approach with Mars. It will be something visible to the naked eye from Earth. Keep posted to my webpage as this develops, since I will be covering this event with detailed information on when and where and what to look for. I also discuss this in my new ebook, Comets. Okay, so enough of that. But some real good listener observations here. Just by the way, last week I made a little misquote or misstatement here. And in my effort to rush and get a lot of material in, I said something, and then I later actually corrected it, but I said last week that comet nuclei are never less than 100,000 miles across. And what I meant to say was that the comet coma, the cloud part of the structure of the comet, the cloud and gas and dust cloud around the comet, are rarely less than 100,000 miles across. So at any rate, I'm sorry for that. I later corrected it in my discussion, but anyway, that just wanted to correct that last week, and then some people may have noticed it. And at one point, I was talking about the moon, and I said Mars. And so, sorry, that's kind of one of the issues of live radio here. Many things going through my head as I'm trying to give this lecture, and especially when you're doing it live. So anyway, I just wanted to correct that, those couple little errors, and I apologize. I'll try and be more articulate and a little bit more careful as I'm moving through these issues. Okay, let me just quick look onto the next topic here. I want to talk about circular logic. Now, here's something that happens too many times in science today. Scientific packages, and I'm going to give a couple instances here, start out with an assumption. And in the case of the solar system, scientists are always talking about 4.5 billion year old solar system. Well, where did they get this number? Really, a long time ago, when NASA and the standard astronomical community was trying to get its act together, they had to come up with some standard stories. One of them was the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which back then was called the Iceball Comet model, or the Whipple Iceball Comet model, right around the 1950s. Then it was later converted to the Snowball Comet model. And then when the nucleus turned out to be dark, they called it the Dirty Snowball Comet model. And then after nucleus became black, it was kind of the dirtier than dirty snowball comet model. At any rate, this idea that the whole solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago and nothing has happened since, gets these underpinnings are the basis for satellite experiments that go out. And so, as with much of science in the United States these days, these are top-down. Somebody writes the proposal, somebody funds it, somebody writes their name on the line for funding for these projects, satellite projects. So the principal investigators and everybody underneath them has to follow suit. I mean, you can't be a guy down in line. Even the principal investigator has his hands tied. He can't come out and say, let me back up a second and let me explain how science should work. You have a proposal, and you say, okay, if this proposal is true, then certain things should follow. That's not the way science is done. And if you hit a contradiction in your data gathering, you have to regroup and say, you know, our initial assumption here is wrong. But never, never, ever is that done anymore. And so you find that the person, in this case, with the moons of Saturn, they go out, they have the Cassini mission that's been orbiting Saturn, and they go, look, all of these moons, because of X, Y, and Z, are 4.5 billion years old. And so it's circular logic. You make an assumption that the solar system and everything is 4.5 billion years ago. You collect your data. You mold the data to prove the assumption, basically because all of your interpretations have to be based on the idea that everything is 4.5 billion years ago, and nothing, certainly nothing electrical, can be introduced. All of these had to be gravitational interactions that happened 4.5 billion years ago, and therefore you come to the conclusion that everything is 4.5 billion years old in these moons. And so this is circular logic. And this occurs because of top-down scientific method here. And this is backwards. You should say, okay, here's a proposal. Here's a proposal that everything is supposed to be 4.5 billion years ago, but you go out to Saturn, and most of the moons, especially the smaller moons, are in all kinds of different orbits around Saturn. Not the nice, neat, prograde orbits of the major satellites of Saturn. And so, what's the problem here? Okay, well, then they have to say, well, gee, these moons are captured. Well, okay, these moons are captured, but what about the other ones? Why aren't they captured? Why don't all the moons of Jupiter have different ages? But you see what I'm saying. The assumption leads to the proposal, leads to the satellite, leads to the principal investigator who has his team of people, and they all have to conclude that the moons are 4.5 billion years old. Circular logic. It is not science, it's a religion, it has nothing to do with reality, but I want to put in and interject another note here, is remember that this is the tier 2 science, this is the garbage science that's pawned off, visible to the public. It's published in the journals, Nature, Science, the Gee Whiz stuff like Scientific American, or Astronomy, or Sky and Telescope, and that's where all of this kind of Gee Whiz stuff comes back, or space.com. By the way, I put a posting on my page this week, and I list off a whole laundry list of pages which I say are, let's see if I can find that note. I put it down here a ways because I didn't want it. Here it is. I stuck it down kind of a ways on the home page. You can find it here down below the Comet Temple 1 link to the Comet Deep Impact page. It says, notice, due to the extreme level of misinformation and distorted reporting on YouTube, Wikipedia, Google, CNN, space.com, spaceweather.com, weather.com, the NOAA websites, and last but not least, the NASA-related websites, as well as many other now government-owned sites. In this list, I would include Forbes. There's just so many sites out there that obviously are pushing the party line. And then I say these sites plus many more taken over by the New World Order and filtered by professional disinformation specialists. And that word filtered is very important because a lot of the people on the staffs of these think that they're actually writing things, but all of this gets very much filtered. But anyway, I go on to say, I must warn my listeners regarding what I now call the information black plague. I should put a TM on that. The information black plague that is permeating every fabric of your life. Literally nothing can be trusted on these sites, especially regarding topics such as outer space or other things that potentially could affect your lives. What I call the real issues, not the plethora of non-issues you see on the controlled evening schmooze news. And then it says, I go on to say, P.S., due to the rash of recent fake postings placing my name and distortions of my work on YouTube, please understand I do not post on YouTube. Never have, never will. YouTube has become a collection pit for every no-name anonymous imposter wannabe and government disinformation agent. Trust nothing you see there. In general, I only post on my own webpage. All my work here is copyrighted, including my radio shows, and I do not give permission to repost them anywhere else. Okay, so anyway, just a few things to kind of clean up the paperwork, dot the I's and cross the T's there. And this is especially important for people who are new to me, new to my work, because there is so much information. People using my names, the clowns at sot.net, oh, the laundry list goes on and on. I had some people that would, every week there's a new surprise about the information that's just being lifted. And a lot of these pages, remember, are supported. Money is hard to come by out there, so a lot of these web pages getting paid, and a lot of times they don't even understand where this money is coming from. They think they got benefactors. But the money is really being slid in under the table, so to speak, from the misinformation crew. And they mold to that where the money comes from. So at any rate, that's why I don't take support. I don't take donations. I don't take anything like that. I simply do what I do. My show is commercial free. And so, you know, you look at these pages. One page even uses my name, and then right underneath it has a donation link. In other words, if you go and search on my name on Google, they'll direct you to this page, and right there is a donation link to go to, you know, it's absolutely out there in the world of internet. It is the, like I say, the best word I could use is the information black plague. So, The YouTube is the collection pit for every no-name, anonymous, imposter, wannabe, and government disinformation agent, and that's about the best thing I can say about it. Okay, enough of that. So, by the way, that later this month we will have Comet Lemon coming into view in the Northern Hemisphere, the green comet lighting up like a light bulb, and that's why I'm doing these shows, by the way, is to inform people what they're going to be seeing. Why does a comet light up like a light bulb? What does it mean? What does that mean in terms of NASA producing data? And by the way, I think I covered this last week, but NASA has a new viewing group that they've organized for Comet Ison. And the whole purpose here is to filter the information and only pawing off on the public the garbage science that, you know, don't talk about the real issues. And one of the first glaring issues of this whole episode, of this whole effort to control the information that comes out to the public. First of all, they're doing it 8 months in advance of any viewing they're talking about. They're talking about November. They're also ignoring the Mars encounter next fall, late September, early October. But they're also talking about the only having professional organizations contribute. But the professional organization, is, it sounds like this big open data network. Everybody's going to be open and free access to everybody's data so we can really look at this. But then they say, but the institutions are all responsible for posting their own data. And I'm sure there was a big outcry from people saying, we're not going to post our data in some general web page run by the Naval Observatory or by Goddard or anybody else. Because it would be just a circus, three-ring circus shooting match, you know, where the little ducks go sideways and you shoot with the pop gun. That's what it would be like, because the contradictions, the bad data, the people would be posting data that they don't want you to see, and it would be just a three-ring circus. Of misinformation and goofy stuff. It's like when people were analyzing a lot of the information that came from the moon. It was just a shooting match because they'd put out information and people would be jumping all over it, showing the contradictions, etc. Okay, so at any rate, back to the Saturn article. Circular logic. Remember that when you start seeing data, especially with comets. There's a new mission out. It's called MAVEN, and I want to spend a little bit of time here on that topic. It's a study of the upper atmosphere of Mars being launched next November from Cape Canaveral. So it's this, by the way, was sent to me by a listener. Once again, thanks for my listeners who are out there scouring the internet, digging up these topics that are really, in a sense, very obscure, not something that would be what you'd call front page news, and then analyzing it and getting that information to me. And obviously, I've got some people out there that know the score. And so anyway, thanks again. I first want to mention something that crossed my desk this week, and it's about the legislation right now in the House of Representatives on immigration reform. So-called immigration reform. And it's being heavily lobbied and written by labor union and big business. They're fighting over this potentially 20 to 40 million workers out there who have no name, they're illegals, and they're scouring over this in the so-called super panel of eight in the legislature, in the House of Representatives, in the U.S. Congress. The super panel of eight is writing this bill, and it's just reminiscent of back in the oil days when the oil companies wrote the legislation regarding oil. And we all know that the disasters that came out of that, the basically breaking the state of California, one of the incidents, but right now, as I said, in immigration reform, the legislature cowing to labor unions and big business so that they are in there slopping at the hog trough over this giant pool of basically low-cost cash labor. And right now, they don't talk about the real issues of immigration. They don't talk about the foreign policy of the U.S. towards these countries, typically Latin American countries, and other countries of the world, or the World Bank role in destroying the economies of these countries, creating the economic disaster that creates the situation where immigrants, their only hope in life is to move to the United States. and work for cash or do whatever they can do. Nobody is talking about any of the issues that have driven these countries and these poor people into basically servitude, a life of slavery, where they're trying to eke out a living, live here, send some money home to the people who have less there, of course, living in the dirt, hand to mouth. Nobody is talking about any of these situations or the cause of any of this, the third world immigration problem. All they're looking for is this pool of labor for profit. You know, I mean, there's other topics like the people that come here en masse and have babies, because having a baby is somewhat of a ticket to stay. They can get the baby into eventually into schools, into health programs, and of course that's what broke California. But it's the only game in town for them. It's the only thing they know. It's the only thing that they have going for them. So the policies, the mispolicies, the misguided policies of the United States, forcing people to do things which are not rational, have 2-3 babies when they can't take care of them. So now what you're going to have is a double population, which has already happened. It's not on the books, and I've talked about this before. And when these people grow up and start having babies again at age 15, within that period of time, we're going to have another 120 million people in this country with nothing to do. This is, anyway, okay, enough of that. Let me see. I'll be talking more in the future also about the C-2012 S-1 viewing that's coming up. Comet Ison will be, May 22nd is the next date I have on my calendar here for Comet Ison with a Mercury alignment. And remember, Comet Ison will still be way out in the solar system. But on April 29th, and this is something I want people to mark on their calendars, and I'll be giving more viewing information as this approaches, Comet Lemon, the one that's coming into the northern hemisphere right now, we'll be seeing it a little later in this month. I'll be giving more viewing information on upcoming shows. But April 29th, Comet Lemon, it's C-2012F6, will be in a perfect electrical alignment with little Mercury. And that's when we could see some sunward spike activity. That means that Comet Lemon is crossing the ecliptic. And listen to my show last week as I describe about the effects of the ecliptic. One astute listener wrote in and asked me why I always talk about the ecliptic being significant for comet excitation. And so I talked about that last week. Make sure you listen to last week's show to understand that. And so anyway, we'll be having such an event here on April 29th. And so, and once again, this could start as early as the 28th. These alignments don't last long. Mercury moves very quickly. The comet will be moving fairly quickly at that point. And so we could see some sunward spike activity on the comet. We could see some Mercury activity. We could see some brightening of the comet as it crosses both the ecliptic plane and has a Mercury electrical alignment both at the same time. It's pretty strong factors there that could influence that comet and the viewing brightening of that comet. I remember a number of years ago I predicted that the comet Holmes on a particular day would explode into brightness, and it did, just like clockwork. And of course, the NASA explanation, oh, it must have got hit by an asteroid. An asteroid hit it. Oh, gee, an asteroid must have hit it just at that particular moment. And it had an electrical alignment. I forget the number of planets. I think it was 3 planets that lined up. It was Mars, Venus, I do recall. And anyway, that's, by the way, that's in my ebook, Comets, and it's also information on my webpage about Comet Holmes. But it became instantly the biggest comet ever to be seen in the solar system size-wise. It was out near the orbit of Jupiter, and it filled up a space in the sky the size of the full moon. an immense, immense, it was literally bigger than the sun physically. It became the biggest object in the solar system. And NASA's excuse, it got hit by an asteroid. It got hit by an asteroid. Every time something happens, which is, and of course these are all explainable by electrical conditions, exactly like Comet Holmes, it got hit by an asteroid. So let's see if an asteroid, according to NASA, hits Comet Lemon on April 29th. Anyway, these things, I see these things coming, and I tell you, it's just like I told you back in January, you were going to start to see some heavy-duty activity. And it was I would call a long shot, the comet C2012S1 interacting with Earth. But we had those conditions, and also the new moon, passing new moon. So at any rate, very important prediction there that really came true. Remember the Tokyo blizzard, the 10 volcanoes in the Kamchatka Peninsula that went off all at the same time, the very low latitude electron auroras that went on, and the 22 state storm system that blanketed the entire east end of the country of the United States, the heaviest flooding in years in New Jersey in January, and in the middle of the dry season, New Orleans had some of the heaviest flooding ever. And certainly, and that includes the wet season, you know, when it rains all summer. Here we are in January, and New Orleans, in the middle of the dry season, is giving some of the heaviest rain, some of the heaviest flooding in the bayous that it has ever seen, including Hurricane Katrina. So at any rate, let me talk quickly about the MAVEN project here with NASA, and thanks once again for a listener who wrote in on this. Let me see. I'm going to pull this up here just a second. Okay, I want to read this because this is a strange, strange mission. Okay, here's a mission to Mars. NASA has apparently been developing this for some time. Technically advanced spacecraft, but it will be launched next November 18th. Given fair conditions at Cape Canaveral. But the mission is being sent to Mars, and that is to study the upper atmosphere and ionosphere of Mars to see why it is so allegedly losing atmosphere. That's one issue. But the name of this mission is very strange. And now it makes one wonder the real reason for this mission, and remember that every mission that's sent out has dual purpose. One is the Tier 1 motivation, which you will never see or hear about. The second motivation is the Tier 2 motivation, which you see or you're told about. And with that, they're saying that Mars supposedly has been losing atmosphere. It lost its oceans. And so it must have happened long ago, so there must be a slow trickling of the Martian atmosphere into outer space. But a number of years ago, about 20 years ago, there was a Mars probe that was sent out to study the Martian atmosphere. And the whole reason for this was because the next probe, they were going to use aerobraking, a technique where you expand a big balloon and basically, as it comes into the atmosphere, it slows down and then bounces when it hits the surface, and then out pops the spacecraft, which was actually done about 10 years after the first probe. But what happened is the first probe measured, took the data on the Martian atmosphere. 10 years later, the actual probe goes out, and they're expecting the Martian atmosphere to be much smaller than what it was. But the Martian atmosphere had literally doubled in size and in density and all its properties. So it was bigger, it was denser, it had more gas. So Mars' atmosphere is increasing. It doubled in a 10-year period. And what that tells me is exactly what I would expect. Mars lost its atmosphere many thousands of years ago. It used to be a blue planet. In historical times, the ancients talk about it. Velikovsky's writing are very clear on that subject about the ancients seeing Mars as a blue planet. And so that means it had its oceans, it had a big atmosphere, because you need a healthy atmosphere to hold that ocean in place. Otherwise, the vapor pressure, it becomes too great. It's like when you go up in the mountains, water boils at a different temperature because the atmospheric pressure is much less. So if you're cooking food, for example, up high in the mountains, cooking times are very different because of the lower atmospheric pressure. Water boils at a much lower temperature, and so it doesn't get as hot, and it doesn't cook your food as fast, as thoroughly as down at sea level. So at any rate, but the end result is that Mars is gaining atmosphere. But this MAVENS issue, they are assuming that Mars is losing atmosphere, so they're going to study the sputtering, they call it, where the solar wind supposedly is taking atmosphere away from Mars. And this is, once again, cyclic science, cyclic circular logic. You start out with an assumption, and so what really should be happening is they should be saying, we're going to go out and study the atmosphere of Mars and see if it's gaining atmosphere, if it's losing it, or what is going on with the atmosphere of Mars. But they're going out with the presumption, with the assumption that Mars is losing atmosphere, and that's what you get to study, Tier 2 science boys at NASA and Goddard and JPL. And so the laundry list of scientists there, standard Tier 2 science, and guaranteed, they're going to find out that Mars is losing atmosphere and comply with all the requirements, because if they don't, they won't be on the next panel. Nobody, it's just not even in the cards. Nobody's going to go against the grain. But what's interesting about this mission is the term MAVEN, which is very unusual. It's an ethnic term. It comes from the Yiddish, and it means someone who has kind of inside knowledge, that uses that inside knowledge to help a network of people. And now, what an interesting term. And also the very unusual, as was pointed out, by the way, the person who wrote in pointed this out, that NASA typically does not use ethnic terms to provide a name for its missions. So let's look at this term MAVEN, M-A-V-E-N. And so you can go on the internet and find, look up MAVEN, and look, it's been used in literature, it's been used in other uses. But here's what I found. MAVENs may act most effectively in collaboration with connectors. Those people have wide network of casual acquaintances by whom they are trusted, often a network that crosses many social boundaries and groups. Connectors can thus easily and widely distribute an advice or insights of a MAVEN. Now, this is really, really interesting. The selection of first an ethnic term to name a spacecraft. Now, look at the timing of this spacecraft. Comet Ison, which I am 100% convinced NASA has probably been watching for years coming into the solar system, finally made the announcement through the Ison Network Institute in Russia, which, by the way, also was the source of Comet Elenin. Remember the huge disinformation campaign that raged over Elenin? All controlled out of a group out of JPL, interestingly enough. And now you see for Comet Ison, for example, the same group of people controlling that information. But with Comet Elenin, remember that the world was going to end 87 different times. And people asked me, and I said, no, there's no Comet Elenin issue here. I had a whole series. I had to waste hours and hours on my radio show telling people that there was no issue with Comet Elenin, and of course there never was. People used my name. Some of those places refused to take the information down, where they're using my name to still claim that Comet Elenin was going to be a threat to Earth. This is after it's long gone, and I told those people, get my name off your webpage, but they won't. Well, that tells you that they're misinformation sites. They're sponsored misinformation sites. SOT.net is a good example. A sponsored misinformation site that is guarded and protected out of France. You know, and that's the way these things work. So, the use of this word maven is very interesting. Let me read again what the most interesting part I found. Remember, maven means basically some kind of information source. And it could be kind of like construed as in the United States, we use an inner city term, weasel. A weasel is someone who snitches on someone else or has private information and goes around, uses it for their own gain or whatever. And so a weasel, it's a very similar type of term, but it can be used for promotion, for gain, for blackmail. It could be used for all sorts of purposes. But look at, once again, this term maven. Mavens may act most effectively in collaboration with connectors. Now, connectors are people who have wide network of casual acquaintances by whom they are trusted, often a network that crosses many social boundaries and groups. Connectors can thus easily and widely distribute the advice or insights of a maven. So the maven is kind of the source of information. And so if you look at this, and you look at not the tier two BS garbage science that's being pawned off in the public, but if you look in the background, like I say, these missions always have a tier one issue that they're trying to resolve, and that's unseen by the public. That goes up the ladder to the world, New World Order, the leaders of the bankers, etc., that fund science, that own science. And then there's the tier two garbage reason that they pawn off on the public. But look at the reason for Maven. Now, look at the concept that in October, a comet will pass by Mars within 7 million miles. And as I said, if NASA, which I thoroughly believe, had been watching this comet come in for maybe 10 years before they announced it, and obviously someone was going to, some layperson, some amateur was going to discover this comet, so they announced it on September 21st, did not name it after the discoverers, which was very unusual for the ISON Institute, in fact, completely out of the norm. And then they, in November, NASA sending a mission to Mars to study the atmosphere . Well, gee, you got a comet coming within 7 million miles. They know that I'm right, that these are not dirty snowballs, that that's going to do some bioengineering of the Martian atmosphere. Something is going to change. It might be a little, it might be a lot, but it's the first time in thousands and thousands of years in which a comet will be coming by an interterrestrial planet that close. Actually, Comet Halley's comet, we went through the tail in 1910, but remember, Halley's was a little poofball of a comet, and there was no ability to measure anything at that time, and there was really not a lot of destruction on Earth or anything to write home about. There was no real issue with Comet Halley because it's just a little nothing comet. Oddly enough, the official size of the nucleus of Comet ISON is only 5 kilometers across, actually smaller than Halley's nucleus. So what's all the big fuss about? Why NASA is predicting this to be the comet of the century? Its closest approach to Earth will be 37 million miles, not exactly neighborhood close. So clearly, that listener's letter that I read at the beginning was very telling. Clearly, NASA knows something, and they're preparing their misinformation campaign, but is the MAVEN mission to Mars also been planned for a long time because they want to get out there and they want to study the Martian atmosphere very soon after the comet goes by? And so it might make you wonder if they have some other craft out there that are already viewing Mars. But anyway, this is to get a look at the Martian atmosphere. And, I mean, we could see electrical connections between that comet and Mars. This comet is coming in on the backside of Mars, zipping in from Jupiter. We could see some Jupiter to Mars electrical interactions. We could see Mars actually going comet, forming a comet tail, drawing in material. It could be sulfur dioxide. It could be hydrocarbons. It could be water. And so we could see some terraforming issues going on Mars. And so isn't it interesting that NASA has a space probe now that's going out there in November, a month after this comet is coming by Mars, and it would tell me specifically that NASA has known for a very long time that this comet is coming by Mars, and it's going to be a major event, and they need to send something out there to look at this. But remember that in the official announcements, NASA still is not talking about the Mars encounter with the comet. In some of the very, you might say, back, out-of-the-way places, it's hinted at, but nothing major. In the places where it should be, it's simply missing. So at any rate, okay, that's the MAVEN issue. I will be talking about that in future episodes. Okay, I've got a few minutes left here, so I want to review the last couple weeks I was talking about last week and the week before. So let's just look at the idea of equipment taking pictures of comets and comet nuclei and the coma that surrounds the comet. So let's take, first of all, just a quick review of what a comet is. There's the nucleus, which is a hard, rocky, solid object, usually odd shaped. The bigger they are, the more chance they have of actually being round because of the gravitational formation. Basically, if they get big enough and molten enough, then the gravity pulls them into a sphere shape. But the little ones are usually potato shaped or kind of odd shaped. Okay, then you have, because of the plasma discharge, discharging the solar capacitor, charges the nucleus up to a negative potential, and all of this is explained in my books. The comet draws in the positively charged dust and ions and etc. in the region on to the far side of the sun, and this is because of the way the electric fields form, also explained in my books, etc. Okay, so now you have an inrush of ions, of molecules, of atoms. And what do? They combine. You have a plethora. You have a vast number of free electrons. You have the ions coming in. And so you have just a mixing pool of chemical activity where you can form all the hydrocarbon chains, the nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, which is water, and the other various forms of OH combinations, oxygen, hydrogen. You have the big hydrogen cloud, which surrounds the comet nucleus. It's the shielding cloud. You have the electron current sheet coming out from the sun that causes X-rays to the sunward side of the comet nucleus, passes through the comet and lights it up like a light bulb. If it's intense enough, you can actually see a significant amount of illumination, in other words, like a light, literally like a neon light bulb lighting up. And so that was a couple weeks ago, where I concentrated on what happens when that electron beam passes through the comet and literally lights it up like a light bulb. You have basically a neon light bulb in space. A neon light bulb, for those of you who look up the neon signs, it's basically a glass tube that contains a rarefied, near vacuum, but a rarefied gas. Typically, neon is one of the more popular gases, but there are many other gases that you can use to get different colors. And then, of course, they paint the glass tube to get different color effects. But basically, you have a high voltage electrical connection on the end of the tube, What that does is it excites an electron current to pass through the tube. Those electrons hit the gas molecules in the tube, excite them up to an excited energy level, and then when the electrons drop back down in the energy levels in the molecules and atoms, it gives off light. To do that, you need an electrical current. This is where standard science drops the ball. When they discovered the X-rays with Hayao Kotake in 1996, that was the point at which standard science had to drop the idea of luminescence in comets. They just couldn't talk about it anymore because there was only one source, only one possible source for that, and that was my explanation, the plasma discharge comet model, where the electrical current is literally passing through the comet nucleus, like just like a neon light bulb in the sky. The only thing in the comet, you don't have a glass tube. The gases are contained by the electric field of the comet drawing them in. And so you get the families of molecules being formed, the carbon monoxide. So you have carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and you actually have all the way up to the nucleotides of DNA forming in comet tails. You have viruses forming in comet tails. These are naturally occurring structures. That's why when we pass through the inferior conjunction of Venus every year, we have, in fact, the formation of viruses. They fall in. They affect the swines first. They migrate to the birds. They transform to a bird virus, and that is most easily they start out with the bird viruses, the chickens and the other especially domesticated animals and birds. They go to the swine, and that's more similar to a virus that is human, the swine flu. That's why they call it the swine flu, a lot of times the bird flu. But these are naturally occurring flus, and then, of course, you got your mill boys out there creating those super viruses in the laboratory and distributing them, calling them naturally occurring viruses, but basically they're building on the naturally occurring viruses from outer space that migrate into our planet here. And then the last week I talked about measuring the size of nucleus with radio telescopes, and I did some research this week showing how the Goldstone satellite, the antenna, radio antenna, is hundreds of times more accurate. You can measure details on planets or comet nuclei down to the range of about 10 feet. So you know they have this method of measuring the size of a nucleus, but what do? They let a science so-called expert estimate the size of a nucleus based on what they call water production, based on the dirty snowball comet model, which is incorrect. At any rate, just remember to go to the webpage. My new ebook is there. All of the water filter products, jmccsci.com. And I will see you next week. We'll be talking more about science, about the issues that really affect your life. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.